Up next, predicting earthquakes. Yeah, you think you can do it? Maybe. For scientists who study earthquakes, being able to predict a quake to give people, let's say, enough time to prepare or to get out of the way, it's sort of the holy grail of their research and their jobs. And now seismologists are working at the famous Parkfield, California site, which is loaded with instrumentation, say that they might be one step closer to such an early warning system. Using very ultra-sensitive instruments and lots of computing power, they actually were able to detect minute changes in seismic waves that preceded two earthquakes. So they were given, the forbearance that these earthquakes were going to happen hours before the quake. One was 2 hours, one was 10 hours. Joining me now to talk more about it is my guest, Paul Silver, senior staff scientist in the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institute for Science in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here.
Tell us about what you were able to discover.
Well, we initially were interested simply in demonstrating that you could observe minute changes in how rocks are stressed at the depth where earthquakes occur. So that's at about a few kilometers depth. So we did a study using the SAFOD hole. This is a drill hole into the San Andreas Fault. And another hole next door. So we had two holes, and we had a source and a receiver at 1 kilometer depth, and we were able to measure stress by measuring the travel time between these two points very, very precisely over time. And our initial goal was simply to demonstrate you could measure barometric pressure. So this is a known source of stress, very small, but it's one that's known. And that was really a way to calibrate our instruments and so on. And we were able to successfully do that. But then we were very surprised by two very large signals in the second month that we were recording that had obviously nothing to do with barometric pressure. And we were scratching our heads just trying to figure out what was going on here. And then we looked at the local seismicity and calculated local earthquakes and calculated how much influence various earthquakes would have. And by far the largest earthquake and the closest one, which was this magnitude 3 earthquake, corresponded very closely in time to the to this one big excursion, this first big excursion that we saw. And, of course, the interesting part of it is that it started about 10 hours before the earthquake.
So would it be oversimplifying it to say that you saw the rocks being squeezed together 10 hours before the earthquake actually happened?
That is probably that's probably pretty reasonable way of thinking about it.
So why would that be a predictor of the earthquake? What happens in the earthquake that the rocks, I guess they would be squeezed in advance?
Yeah, the early laboratory experiments suggested that right before failure, you actually start getting very small cracks in the rock, and these cracks actually change the seismic velocity. And so that's really the basis for it. So really it's a sign of impending failure.
So when the rocks get squeezed together, they get more dense, and it's like putting your ear to the railroad track. You can feel the wave a little before you could hear it.
Yeah, it just changes the velocity. If you squeeze a rock, if you stress it, it'll change the velocity. And that change is what we're looking for.
Now, you had success in two occasions, one 10 hours before and one 2 hours before, but you missed one. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
And what was different about that?
The first month of recording, there was a magnitude 2.6 where we thought we ought to see something, again, based on the predicted influence of these events. We didn't see it, and that's something that we can't entirely explain. Although the first month was the signal levels were a lot lower. We had a lot more trouble with noise. So that could be one possibility. The second month was a lot better. We had a lot better signal. Things were a lot cleaner. So that could be one likely reason.
Now, I've been to Parkfield many times over the last 20 years and seen the instrumentation. You must have done something differently with these instruments this time because you were not able in the last times to detect.
Well, this is a very specific kind of experiment, measuring changes over time in seismic velocity. So this particular kind of experiment had not been done at Parkfield before. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is this drill hole, the so-called SAFOD drill hole, was not available until this time. Mm-hmm. So we really had a unique opportunity for having two holes that allowed us to basically sample the rocks at depth. So in this case, about 1 kilometer depth, and that's getting close to where earthquakes actually occur. So we're kind of closer to where the action is.
It's amazing that you could tell the difference in speed between, you know, in such a small distance apart.
Yeah, it's a very precise measurement. The changes in travel time, which is what we're measuring, are on the order of microseconds. So we're really measuring, our signal is microseconds, our noise is mm-hmm. better than that. It's maybe a fraction of a microsecond.
And is this is what you're measuring, is this what's known as the P wave that's given off?
Well, primarily we're measuring S waves.
S
waves appear to be more sensitive to this micro cracking that I told you about. Mm-hmm. So we were primarily looking at not only the direct S wave, but also what's called the coda, and that is, these are shear waves that are scattered by the various fractures in the medium. But it's primarily S waves because, again, they're more sensitive to this micro-fracturing, micro-cracking that we think we're seeing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about earthquake prediction with Paul Silver. Let's talk about now where you go from here. I mean, how close is any of this to truly predicting earthquakes?
Well, at this stage, we're certainly not predicting earthquakes. I think the step that scientists are really on, the step that we're working on right now, is trying to identify precursors that come before, that are observed to come before earthquakes, that we could then ultimately use for prediction. Foreshocks are the only class of precursors that seismologists really agree upon. You know, these little earthquakes that come before big ones, and we're still arguing about any other one that might be useful. So this is certainly a candidate, but what we want to do, we were only down there for 2 months, as you point out, we have two successes. The first thing we want to do is go back down, and we have an opportunity to do this in September and to record longer term. So if this actually is a you know, repeatable phenomena that we can see over and over again, then that would certainly be an important step for us. Second thing we want to do is that this is really a demonstration experiment in sort of a natural laboratory. What we ultimately would want to do is to measure the same phenomena, but use it in a way that's more practical and over a much larger scale. And we're planning to do that as well. So using more powerful sources of seismic energy at the surface, and also using seismographs at the surface, so that we can observe this phenomena over the scale of tens of kilometers, of, you know, this is sort of the size of a full fault zone.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking with Paul Silver, senior staff scientist at Carnegie Institute for Science in Washington. How many of these sites would you like to really have? I'll give you the Science Friday blank check question. If Carnegie could give you this blank check to drill as many holes as you want, where would you go? Would you move out of that fault line into other places? Maybe even go into, you know, New Madrid or something like that?
No, you wouldn't go to New Madrid. You want to go to a place where you can practice a lot. You can practice on having lots and lots and lots of earthquakes. So New Madrid has a few, but you know, it takes about 100 years for a big one. So you want to go where
you're
going
to wait a while for that one. Yeah.
You know, there on the San Andreas Fault, there are some areas that are active. There's a region in Cascadia now that actually has slow earthquakes that occur every 14 months or so. So you want to, again, we're still in the sort of experimental stage. So we want to go to a place where a natural laboratory where we can have a lot of practice. So areas like China, there's a tremendous amount of seismicity in China, also in Japan, and other parts of the San Andreas Fault system. So it would be nice to have perhaps one or two of these natural laboratories. But as I mentioned, ultimately you want to use that take that information, that there's actually something worth measuring down there, and then come up with a more practical scheme that allows you to look over a larger area. Drilling two holes fairly close together is not a way to sample a large region.
Do you think you can get cooperation or assistance of other countries like China, places like that?
We're already collaborating both with the Chinese and the Japanese, who of course are motivated by the same problem. So we are already doing that. Mm-hmm. And of course, we would like to continue and try to strengthen those ties if we can.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can get a phone call or two. 1-800-999-8255. Let's go out to California. Brian in Sausalito. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, hi, guys. Listen, I just had a question which you touched on about the practical aspects of this. I mean, let's say that you do achieve even a shred of the Holy Grail of being able to get a clue about an imminent earthquake from this method. How are you going to go along on something like the Hayward Fault, probably the most lived-upon fault in the world, and sink these shafts every few miles?
You're afraid of something happening? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I would think so. Yeah, the Hayward Fault is, you know, it's not overdue, but it's due.
Yeah, again, the way to we're not advocating duplicating this geometry all over the world. I mean, I that's like, you know, this, it's good to consider this to be a laboratory, and you know, eventually, if you're convinced that you have the right phenomena, you move out of the laboratory and go out into the field. So in this case, that would mean, as far as I'm concerned, putting larger sources of seismic energy, and there are controlled sources that we can do that, and seismometers at the surface, or at least drill down to modest drill holes, say down to 200 meters, which allows them to be, they're much quieter if they're a little bit away from the surface. Mm-hmm. But that kind of geometry still samples this seismogenic region down 5-10 kilometers depth. It also samples other, you know, other more shallow regions that we're not interested in. But you know, seismologists are, that's part of what they do, is try to separate what the signal that they're interested in from noise. So I think you would not want need to have to drill necessarily holes everywhere, but just to
come up
with a way to get the same information.
You need a proof of concept first.
Pardon me?
You need a proof of concept.
Yeah. That's right.
And then you could just not drill as deeply in many different places.
That's right.
Stay near
that's
the
right.
surface. Well, good luck to you. Do you have another drill coming up, or is another test or anything?
Well, as I mentioned, we're going back into the same hole in September, and we're going to keep recording, continue to record, and we should be able to see more of these, and that would certainly give us more confidence. And the other thing is, we are already moving on this large on this larger scale. So we also have a first stage experiment in October, also back in Parkfield, to try out a larger source and more seismometers, so we can, instead of sampling over this very small region, we can sample over maybe 10, 20, 30 kilometers.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Silver.
Okay, thank you very much.
Paul Silver, Senior Staff Scientist in the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institute for Science in Washington. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth, Flora Lichtman, and Senior Producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is also our digital media producer. Our interns are Christopher Intagliata and Liz Burns. Josh Rogerson is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We got podcasts and iTunes and on our website and video podcasts. And we're blogging and still talking with folks over there in Second Life. I'm Ira Flato in New York.